Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Today's Current State is a great opportunity to learn more about several issues here as I look at our segments for this hour, about several issues that we've all heard of, but they're the kinds of issues, if you're like me, they're the kinds of issues that you have always felt you didn't know quite enough about. There's more going on here than you've ever had time to really explore. We're going to learn more about the Racer Trust in Lansing. That's the organization that's involved, that's overseeing the redeployment, the revitalization of all of the former GM plant sites in Lansing and all around the country. Supply chain. You've heard of supply chain management and the role that that has in the modern economy. We got a segment on supply chain today. Proposal 1, all voters in Michigan will be facing Proposal 1 in less than a month. A chance to revisit that issue and find out what it's all about. We also are off to Ann Arbor for, we just had the corpse flower bloom here in East Lansing at Michigan State. They have an equally uncommon development in Ann Arbor with the blooming of an agave plant at the University of Michigan, and that is expected to draw big lines. This plant, it's the first time it's bloomed in 80 years. We'll speak with someone from the Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor coming up this hour on Current State. I hope you can stick around. This week, Lansing area residents had an opportunity to learn more about what's happening at the large vacant tracts of land along West Saginaw where General Motors factory buildings once stood. Racer Trust, the company that manages the properties, held a public meeting Tuesday to give an update on their plans to clean up the sites. Here to tell us more, Current State's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. The sites we're talking about used to be the GM Craft Center, the Metal Forge site, and the Fisher Body plant. And they stood for decades along the West Saginaw corridor. All of them were torn down by 2005. In the last 18 months, officials have found chemical contamination on the grounds, specifically a solvent called 1,4-dioxane, which GM used extensively. I visited the site with Stephen Hayward. He is the planning and development director for Lansing Township, and he explained to me what 1,4-dioxane is and where it's located.
It's used in a lot of things. It's used in toothpaste, but at a concentration much less than what they've discovered below the surface here. It used to be used to clean the presses. It would cut through the oil and would allow them to get to the machinery, and it wasn't known to be a contaminant. And so it was used in massive amounts. And over a period of time, it filtered in through those press pits down into the ground and then started to migrate to the south about a quarter mile away.
Aside from the fact that in the last decade, this area has just simply been a large concrete brownfield, what did the loss of all these GM facilities mean for the township, for the economy, the tax base, the sense of identity of the residents?
Well, I think there's two issues. One is there's some residents that are on the east side of the property that are in a very stable neighborhood that necessarily didn't feel like they benefited from the General Motors plants. They were more geared towards the state government to the east, and I'm referring to the west side neighborhood of Lansing. Very strong neighborhood, very passionate about trying to protect their quality of life. And then you have on the other side of the tracks, which is literally a railroad track, is a Lansing Township residents, which were workforce housing. Those were homes that were occupied by people who worked directly for General Motors. And what we saw with the closing of the plants was an out-migration of that population. And a lot of those homes went from owner-occupied, the relatively small workforce housing, and they became rentals. And as an outcome of that, we've seen the neighborhood slip a little bit. And last week, the township adopted a rental ordinance. We were the last community in the region to adopt one. In the past, we hadn't felt that we needed one. Now we do, because we've seen these neighborhoods go through a transition period, and we need to be a little more involved in making sure that the neighborhood's stabilized and the housing stock is stabilized.
What do you envision seeing here one day?
I think that what we'll have is a combination of some housing on portions of it, some light industrial, some retail, potentially some office, but we're a mile away from the state capitol, and from this point you can actually see the state capitol, so it's it needs to be something. It would disappoint me if 10 years from now I looked back and see that in the capital city in the state of Michigan, we are not able to revitalize 200 acres to benefit both the residents of the region and the state of Michigan.
Stephen Hayward is the Director of Planning and Development for Lansing Township. Thanks for giving me the update.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And joining me now in the Current State studio is Patricia Spitzley. Patricia is the Deputy Redevelopment Manager for the Racer Trust, the caretaker agency for the former General Motors sites. Patricia, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
The meeting you attended on Tuesday night, rather, was an opportunity for Racer Trust to update the public on these cleanup efforts at the GM sites in Lansing. What did Racer officials say?
Yeah, we have those meetings as part of our continual outreach to our communities. We have, 89 communities in 14 states, and so we regularly provide these information sessions. What we shared with them on Tuesday was the results of almost a year-long continuing testing of the site, and talking about the 1,4-dioxane that was discovered on the site. Mm-hmm. Telling them that we've done extensive testing. As a matter of fact, since the trust was formed in 2011, we've installed 32 monitoring wells, drilled nearly 350 borings, and collected, almost 1,500 soil and groundwater samples. So last year when we had a meeting, this time last year, right after that meeting, we discovered this 1,4-dioxane. And as Steve Hayward said, it's in a variety of things, but what GM used it is an additive to stabilize some industrial solvents. What we wanted to convey to the residents there is that this 1,4-dioxane plume does not extend to the municipal drinking water, and that we've been working with Department of Environmental Quality to develop a plan to address the contamination that's on the site.
You've already demonstrated through your testing that 1,4-dioxane is not getting into the public water supply.
Yes, we have.
You've conclusively demonstrated that.
Yes, we have. And we've worked with the Lansing Board of Water and Light to do that. We recognize that is a wellhead protection area, and that there are a number of wells around there that contribute to the drinking water in the community. And so we immediately reached out to the Lansing Board of Water and Light and worked with them to do the testing to make sure that this contaminant does not impact those drinking water areas.
And how did the public respond? Or what kind of questions did they have? What was the tone of the meeting in terms of the relationship between Racer officials and just the general public at the meeting?
I think that there is concern. I mean, of course, when you're talking about a contaminant, there's always concern about adverse impacts. And so we've been very open and very careful to explain that there are no adverse impacts from this, but that it is something that we need to address and to clean up. Another thing that was discussed was a concern about some of the activity on the site. We have contracted with a third party to have cars parked on the site, and there was some concern about the increased traffic there. And what we took away from that is that we need to be a little bit more vigilant in what's going on, and we need to make calls to make sure that any negative activity or disruptive activity in the neighborhood is minimized.
The members of the public are just parking their cars there?
No, it's a third party we've contracted with who are parking cars from the General Motors plant. And it's a long story. Basically, the winter, and it was, the cars that needed to be parked there so that they can be shipped out to other dealerships.
Patricia Spitzley is our guest. Patricia is the Deputy Redevelopment Manager for Racer Trust, the caretaker agency for the former GM sites here in Lansing. So you alluded to your proposed remediation plan that you've sent to the DEQ. How do you intend to clean up the toxins there specifically?
Well, it involves basically pumping out the contamination, treating the water, and pumping it back in, basically recirculating the water through. So it pushes the contamination back to our treatment area, and then once we treat the water, we pump the clean water back in. It's a process that takes a while, but we're working with the DEQ, and if they if they approve the plan, that's one of the cleanup strategies that we're going to employ.
How long is a while? Do you know? I mean, are we talking months or years?
We're talking years.
Okay.
But I want you to know that how the Racer Trust was formed, we were formed with cleanup dollars specifically for this site. And we recognize that it's going to take a while, but the Trust's mission is to clean up the sites and position them for redevelopment. And so we do have those dollars to address the legacy environmental issues at the site.
Do you think the public might get impatient with the fact that it's going to take years, or do you think they're tolerant of that?
I think that there is concern about the site and concern that there hasn't been redevelopment at the site. But I think there are two things to consider. The first thing is that we can market the site, and we continue to market the site for redevelopment separate from the environmental cleanup. And even if there is remediation going on at the site and someone purchases that property, they are comforted in that they do not have to assume those legacy environmental costs. The unique feature about Racer is that we will continue our environmental responsibilities even after we sell the site or a portion of the site to someone else.
Steve Hayward mentioned a minute ago that the township's housing stock needs stabilizing. Do you see residential as part of the GM site?
Well, one of the things that we do and when we work with local government is we talk to them about what their economic development vision is for the site. You know, what would they like to see there? And then based on those discussions, we put together a marketing brochure and we market the site in accordance with their wishes. Keeping in mind that Racer is the owner and in its sole discretion has the ultimate decision on selling a piece of property, but we don't make those activities. We don't do those activities in a vacuum. We work very closely with the local government. And so, input from Steve Hayward and input from the Lansing Township, input from the City of Lansing is important for Racer when we are marketing the properties.
How much has Lansing Township shared with you about what they'd like to see there?
We have a great partnership with Lansing Township. We have a great partnership with the City of Lansing, and we own property in Delta Township and meet regularly with them. And so we receive input from them on a regular basis. We provide them input on our marketing efforts. If there is someone who is interested in a piece of property in their community, we make sure to the extent that we can that interested party meets the vision of the community.
You could divvy up. How many acres are we talking about here in Lansing or Lansing Township?
About almost 300 if you're talking Delta Township, Lansing Township, and the City of Lansing. And we do have the ability to split up the property. We recognize that it's unlikely that someone's going to want to come in and buy the whole footprint. And so we market the property as a whole, but we're also willing to sell off pieces of the property.
This is interesting because I'm told you grew up in a GM family.
I did. My father-in-law worked at the Kraft Center there. I have cousins who work in GM right now. I have family that worked at the Fisher Body plant. And so the revitalization of this area is very important to me. I remember those facilities mm-hmm. there, and I remember the people that used to work there.
But 300 acres, this could be a patchwork of all different kinds of redevelopment over the long term.
Absolutely.
That's how you see it? I mean, you see residential. You see light industrial. I don't know. Do you see heavy industrial?
Possibly for the heavy industrial, but absolutely. I mean, if you look at the Saginaw corridor there, where our property right along Saginaw, and we have property on either side of that corridor, it's a great place for commercial. Okay. We have a partnership where we're working with the Lansing Board of Water and Light. They just issued a request for proposal for solar.
Yeah.
And we have been fortunate that they've asked us to include our properties in that RFP, and so there could be solar there. So there's a variety of options for redevelopment at that site.
Very interesting. Patricia, we'll have you back. Patricia Spitzley is the Deputy Redevelopment Manager for Racer Trust here in Lansing. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. its current state on 90.5 WKAR. As midsummer arrives, we enter the heart of baseball season with next week's All-Star Game. And music festival season comes to a head with this week's Common Ground event. The work of MSU's Dr. Hakan Yildiz has touched both worlds. Dr. Yildiz is Assistant Professor of Supply Chain Management at MSU's Eli Broad College of Business. His interests have taken him from his native Turkey to Pittsburgh's Carnegie Mellon University here to East Lansing. Hakan's Carnegie Mellon PhD thesis included a study of the logistical challenges of moving Major League Baseball umpiring crews around the country. Hakan Yildiz shared that and other stories with WKAR's Peter Whorf when the two sat down in our studios yesterday. Dr. Yildiz started off their talk with a quick supply chain 101.
Historically, when we talk about supply chain, we are talking about the physical flow of goods starting from raw material stage through manufacturing and then through and that reaches the customers, and in between you have the logistics activities and the information technology that coordinates all of that activity. That resource management idea is not obviously it's not restricted to the physical resources, and there is the human resources aspect, which becomes very important, which has become very important in the recent years, especially as our economy, as the U.S. economy, is moving from, especially towards a services-oriented industry and economy. So the principles that was developed over the years in the context of physical supply chains are now being transferred to services industry. So that is really the trend right now, okay, applying the same principles into similar problems. Okay. So that brings us to the umpire scheduling idea.
The movement of umpires around the major league ballparks in the most efficient manner.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So so that was a project that was part of my PhD thesis. So the idea is, as you mentioned, it boils down to efficiently managing the resources, which are now, in this case, the umpires, so that the total transportation costs are minimized. So you don't want to take these umpires from East Coast to West Coast and then West Coast to East Coast with consecutive games. That would be really expensive and also very tiring to the umpires. But the other thing that is important is there's a need to balance the types of games that these umpires referee. They are not supposed to see the same team in consecutive games, whether at road or at home. So there's this fairness issue that the Major League Baseball really emphasizes. And also there is a lot of different details of like vacation times of umpires, the different events that takes place at the ballparks.
There are many circumstances that must be considered in this process, not only the travel of the umpires, but there are certain stipulations, like you say, can't do a couple of games in a row, the crews have to mix in different ways.
True. There is a lot of very interesting rules that goes into that problem and makes it very difficult to plan for. And the interesting thing, if maybe many people wouldn't know that, as opposed to the teams, the umpires do not have a home base. So so after each game, they don't really go back to their home. They go from game to game. So it's like a delivery truck that makes stops at different locations.
They're perpetually on the road.
That makes it with the constraints that we mentioned, the problem becomes very difficult to optimize. For that, you really need sophisticated algorithms and methods to come up with a good schedule. Basically, that was what we were after, developing these methodologies that can result in better solutions fairly quickly.
This is Peter Wharf for Current State. I'm speaking with Hakan Yildiz, who is on the Faculty of Supply Chain Management here at Michigan State University. Another project you told me about that I think is a little more recent applies to the idea of shows or productions traveling around a large geographical area. Here in Lansing, we're in the middle of one of the biggest ones of the year right now, Common Ground in downtown Lansing, where musicians, crews, stages, and other technology are having to move from place to place, intersecting, moving apart in different ways. How does that work, and how does your work intersect with those ideas?
Yeah, again, the same idea of resource management and aligned with transportation goes into this application as well. I'm working with a company, Lansing-based company, called SGA Production Services, which provides seating and staging services for large scale entertainment events, such as outside hockey games or the Carrier Classic, the basketball games on the Navy aircraft carriers, or large corporate events, meetings with, let's say, hundreds or thousands of people. And first of all, this company is Lansing-based, strangely enough. So it is, but they operate nationally. So they have several warehouses throughout the United States. So the president of the company, Mr. Tom Hilton, I would like to recognize him, basically reached out to me because he saw my umpire scheduling work and saw the resemblance. And then we started to talk. We had a very interesting several conversations to frame the problem. Basically, the idea is, so they have these events that are coming from all over the United States, and they need to send their seating, staging types of equipments to serve those events. And they need to decide at the time of basically calling their customers, like, how are we going to serve this customer? From which warehouse we need to ship? How many of these quantities? Sometimes the nearest warehouse does not have enough equipment, so they have to do multiple shipments from different warehouses, such as for large events like Carrier Classic. So, and then after the event, what do we do with that equipment? Do we send back to the nearest warehouse or somewhere else in anticipation for future demand? So the idea becomes similar to that umpire scheduling problem. So the resources travel throughout the United States from event to event and between warehouses as if floating around. And it becomes a complex problem to optimize again. So basically, what are we trying to optimize? Basically, the decision at the time of the planning, right before the event takes place. What is the best way of satisfying this customer's needs?
In this discipline of supply chain management, we've also spoken before about the notion of helping companies and businesses and people to save money, but also the notion of eliminating waste.
I'm glad you touched upon that. Yeah, that's actually, so I had been having as a human being, right? So you look for a purpose in what you're doing, right? Aside from being a job, so how do you motivate yourself of doing something good for the world? Mm-hmm. And that was the idea that really helped me over the years. The work that we are really after, we are not really designing new, let's say, life-saving equipments, or we are not these are some innovations or things that people immediately can relate to. But what we do is, as you said, boils down to eliminating waste. Right. So how can we do things better, plan for things better, control them better, so that we can do more things with the same resources that we have. And that waste elimination really is a noble idea, I think. And that really helps me in the work that I'm doing. We are helping companies. So when they grow, obviously the economy grows, more jobs. Mm-hmm. And that's a direct benefit to the whole community, I believe.
Yeah, I don't think you really have to dig too deep to realize that let's say when you're, for example, shortening a driving distance or shortening a flight time, you immediately see savings there, but also benefit to everyone, let's say with a carbon footprint becomes less.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right on that. Yeah. So, like one of the examples that I give in my transportation class to the students is when I start talking about optimization. So I tell them, well, you really do optimize some of your activities without really noticing them. One is like finding the shortest path between two points, right? So you basically log on to a routing website like Google Maps or MapQuest, or using your GPS device, right? So that tells you basically the best way to take. And that, how does it tell us? Basically, it does, it basically defines, uses some background heuristics or algorithms that gives the best solution. And once you do that, and once everyone does that, it eliminates fuel that we consume.
And time.
Time, yeah. And there is a direct benefit both to our economy, our environment, and our daily lives.
Dr. Hakan Yildiz is with Michigan State University's Department of Supply Chain Management. Dr. Yildiz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Peter. It was a pleasure.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. On August 5th, Michigan voters will head to the polls to select who goes on to represent each party in November's general election. They'll also be asked to vote on Proposal 1, which is the first step in what's been a long-fought effort to reform the state's personal property tax. The tax, which businesses have long argued hinders growth, has also been a crucial source of revenue for many Michigan municipalities. But Proposal 1 seems to have few detractors. Most in the business community and in local government alike are for its passage. A recent report out by the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, an independent, nonpartisan research organization that analyzes public policy questions, took a deeper look at what effects Proposal 1 might have in the future. It turns out that despite little opposition, reforming the personal property tax does come with some costs. Here with us now to break down Proposal 1 is Eric Lufer. Eric's the CRC's research director. We'll point out this is the first in our regular check-ins with the Citizens Research Council to help us understand public policy issues here in Michigan. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a pretty basic question. There aren't very many vocal special interests on any part of the political spectrum, from the Chamber of Commerce to the Michigan Municipal League, that are coming out in opposition to what voters will see on the ballot come August 5th, to Proposal 1. If that's the case, why should people care?
Mark, thanks for having me here today. Citizens Research Council weighs in on all issues that get on a statewide ballot because we think that better information leads to better decision-making. In this case, it's the people that are making the decision on public policy. And the question, to answer your question relative to this, we're committing money into the future to reimburse local governments for this foregone revenue. Once this is fully phased in, we're talking about at least $500 million. And it's a question for the voters whether they want that $500 million going to reimburse local governments for lost personal property tax revenues or being used for schools, for roads, for everything else that government pays for.
We're talking about the repeal of the personal property tax, but the property we're talking about is for business and commercial use, which can be misleading. In this context, what exactly are we talking about when we say personal property?
Right. So there's two kinds of property as far as the government cares. There's what we call real property, which is the land and the buildings put upon that land. And then personal property is everything put upon that or put inside the building. So an example would be the machinery that industry uses, the computers, the desks, the tables, equipment, all that kind of stuff is considered personal property. And specifically for this question, it's mostly industrial personal property. So to think about the auto plants in the state or the chair manufacturing over on the west side of the state, things like that, it's all that machinery to use to produce this stuff that is really at stake with this question.
And what are some of the reasons businesses, a lot of people don't like taxes for all kinds of reasons, but specifically, what are the reasons that businesses don't like this tax?
Well, there's two reasons. One is a general public policy in Michigan and every other state is they want more business to locate here, and they see this as a disincentive. If you want more of something, if you want less of something, tax it. So if you want more of something, tax it less. So the question is, if we get rid of the personal property tax, will that lead to more businesses choosing to locate in Michigan? The other part of it is businesses see this as double taxation. When they purchase a good, when they purchase a computer, a forklift or whatever, they pay a sales tax on it, and then they put it in their property and they have to pay the personal property tax upon it. So they see it as double taxation.
Eric Lufer is our guest. Eric's research director of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. We're talking about Proposal 1. This would approve a method of reimbursing or recreating revenue for municipalities here after the elimination of Michigan's personal property tax. Many cities and townships have relied on the PPT for a substantial part of their annual revenue. Why are municipalities in support of Proposal 1?
They're in support because it's the best deal they're going to get at this point. This idea of getting rid of personal property taxes has been a long time coming. The Citizens Research Council has reports going back to the 1960s exploring ways that this could have been reduced. The current legislature, the current administration is pushing real hard for this. So the Municipal League, the Township Association, the counties, schools were fighting this for a long time because they wanted to make sure they were going to get their money through a series of negotiations in 2012 through 2014. They came up with this deal that is going to come pretty close to 100% reimbursement. So they feel they're not going to be harmed by it, and they're willing to support it.
Oh, where is it going to come from?
That's the reason we're having this tax or having this vote. What they're doing to reimburse it is to redirect part of the state's use tax from the current state purposes, where it's being paid for general fund purposes, corrections and welfare and everything that the state does, everything here in Lansing. It'll be redirected from that to being used to sent to local governments. And it's being done through this convoluted system where they created a statewide local unit of government. And that local unit of government will be ostensibly levying this tax. And any time in Michigan that you have a local government proposing to levy a tax, the people have the right to vote on it.
Mm-hmm. I take it communities with bigger commercial development, with more commercial development, tend to be more reliant on the tax.
Right.
Mostly
industrial property, not where you have a big shopping mall, but where you have a lot of industry in your jurisdiction. So to think about the usual suspects, Lansing with the auto facilities, Southeast Michigan with so much industry, the autos, the suppliers, everything like that. The west side of the state with Grand Rapids and Holland with the facilities they have. Midland is actually one of the most dependent on personal property taxes, and a lot of places up north as well.
Mm. This taps into a history of mistrust between the state and local municipalities. Can you share some of the history behind why local municipalities are mistrustful of the legislature when it comes to revenue sharing?
Right. When you go back and look at the history of fiscal relationships between the state and its local governments, it starts back in the 1930s when the state first exempted intangible property from local taxation. And they said, well, we'll send you the money. Don't worry. You won't get this local tax, but you'll get a part of a state tax.
Checks in the mail.
That was short-lived, and the state decided its purposes were more important than the local government purposes. And then this went on in the 1960s. There was some relationships. In the 1970s, they exempted inventory property, and they said, trust us, we're going to send you the money. And then we went through this last decade where the state cut revenue sharing, cut state revenue sharing, cut state revenue sharing, to the point where local governments were out at least $6 billion over that time frame.
So does Proposal 1 provide ironclad protection for municipalities that the legislature won't be able to touch the revenue?
Not ironclad. It is taken out of the appropriations process, so it's not as easy as every year the legislature deciding they need to use that money for something different. But it is put in the statute, and anything the legislature does statutorily, they can undo statutorily. A little more difficult. We have to line up the votes a little more, and of course the municipal league and the counties and townships will be fighting anything that they try to do statutorily. But again, anything they do statutorily, they can undo statutorily.
Eric Lufer's our guest, research director for the Citizen Research Council of Michigan. We're talking about Proposal 1, which will appear on the August 5th ballot here in Michigan. Do many other states have a similar personal property tax?
A lot of states are going down the same road of trying to exempt it, but there are a few still that levy this. Most of our surrounding states, the Great Lakes states, have already gone down this path to exempt the personal property.
Have they gone as far as Michigan is in making an effort to find the revenue, make up for the revenue elsewhere?
They tend to do that. The local governments, of course, are beholden to that revenue. They've budgeted for that revenue. They've looked into the future, counting on that revenue. The difference in Michigan is because of this mistrust between local governments and the state, that we're going through this convoluted system of creating the special authority in the other states, that trust seems to be there, and they say every year we'll get you that money, and the local governments are willing to go along with that.
So this would not have created as much tension if there were a better history of trust between local and state.
Absolutely.
Okay. What will the longer-term effects be on the budget, assuming Proposal 1 is approved by the voters?
Well, as I said, every year there's going to be, over the next 10 years, more and more property exempted. It's phased. The property tax is being phased out over a number of years. So it starts off at about $1 billion that's going to be about $100 million that's being diverted from the state budget in the first year. Eventually, you get down the road where there's about $500,000 being sent to local governments. There is some offset with that.
$500 million.
Yeah. I'm sorry. There's some offset with that with a new state tax that's going to be called a state essential services tax that's going to be levied actually on personal property. So not 100% exemption. They're replacing a local tax with a state tax, but at a lesser rate. And the state's counting on getting some extra money from tax credits that are expiring, things that have been offered back in the Granholm administration when they were trying to get the economy turned around. Those things are coming to expiration, and that'll get new money into the state budget.
So as succinctly as possible, let's close on this note. What are voters really considering here with Proposal 1 coming on August 5th?
The real question is, do you want the state to divert part of its use tax to a local tax? It will end up at the same rate they're paying now. That's not going to increase the amount of taxation to be used for that money to be used to reimburse local governments. It's all about personal property tax reform, a business-friendly move to try to get the economy in Michigan clicking on all cylinders. There's a lot of things hinging on that question of a tax question, voter approval for the tax question.
But it's an effort not to harm municipalities and make good on the revenue that they've been accustomed to through the personal property.
You're exactly right.
Eric Lufer is the research director for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, an independent, nonpartisan research organization that analyzes public policy questions. Thank you, Eric. We'll check in with the CRC again soon.
Can I mention that all this is available on our website at crcmich.org?
Duly noted. Thank you.
All right.
Two weeks ago, we made quite a stink over a flower. The so-called corpse flower attracted long lines of visitors to MSU's Plant Biology Conservatory. The unusual Indonesian plant blooms infrequently and unpredictably. And as if that were not mysterious enough, it smells like rotting meat or flesh. Hundreds of curious people were delightfully grossed out. Now there's another blooming plant that's generating a lot of attention. Ann Arbor's Mathai Botanical Gardens at the University of Michigan announced on Tuesday that blooms were appearing on an American agave plant there. The specimen is 80 years old, and it's the first time it's bloomed since being collected in Mexico in 1934. Mike Palmer is the horticulture manager at Mathai Botanical Gardens, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning.
Our corpse flower created a surprising amount of attention in visitors. Is there a lot of interest in your agave down there?
Yes, there's a lot of interest because of the whole long story of this plant, 80 years old. It's going to, you know, set seeds, and it will die after that. So it's pretty dramatic.
Describe it for us. I understand it's a member of the asparagus family.
Yes, and you can really tell that on the flower stalk. When the flower stalk first appeared, it looked like asparagus on steroids. It was very large, and it grew 6.5 inches a day. Right now, it is 28 feet tall and has many branches on it, so it doesn't look as much like an asparagus, except for the little side leaves that are on the stalk. You can kind of see that when you eat an asparagus and compare the two.
Mm. And it blooms once in its life?
Once in its life, and then falls over and is no more.
That's the beginning of the end.
It is. I was looking at it yesterday more closely, and you can see now the plant, which really has firm leaves that almost look like octopus arms, is starting to have wrinkles in it. And it, I mean, the amazing amount of energy that goes into that flower stalk, I would get all wrinkled up too.
How about that? Well, it's amazing too. The plant is 80 years old. How far into its life cycle does the American agave typically bloom? When does it bloom?
Usually between 15 and 25 years. That is, of course, outdoors, and it's unusual that ours is in a conservatory, though it has happened in a few other places in the last 10 years in a conservatory-like setting in the United States. But, 80 years, I've had docents for years ask me, when do you think it'll flower? Because we know it's a long period of time, and I'd always say, I don't know. And on April 22nd, when I had a volunteer say, there's a flower stalk on the agave. Have you seen it? I almost couldn't believe it.
Why the long delay for your plant to bloom? Do you know?
I don't know. It's impossible to guess.
But it will generate seeds that can be planted, so its lineage can continue, correct?
Yes. It has over 1,000 flower buds, and it also has other ways it reproduces. American agave can have pups at the base, which ours does not have, by the way, and it can also have pups or propagules up amongst the flower buds. After the flower buds have, you know, done their thing and set seeds, these will form, and we're hoping there'll be plenty of both seeds and these propagules or pups on the stalk. We'll just have to wait and see.
Well, do you stand to learn anything that we didn't already know about the agave plant during this bloom, or do we know everything we need to know about the agave plant except why it blooms when it blooms?
Well, for myself, I've never experienced it, and I've had to call around at some of the other public gardens in the South that have them outdoors and ask them questions because I have people asking me questions. Are the flowers fragrant? What will they look like? And, you know, there's photos on the web that you can look at. But they're not that showy. The individual flower, it's mostly the reproductive parts, the anthers and the stigma stick up out of the partially open bud, and that's about it. But because there's 1,000 of them and they have, you know, the yellow color, they're impressive in number. But individually, it's a little bit, I don't know, kind of a letdown.
Mike Palmer is the horticulture manager at Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor. We're talking about Mathai's 80-year-old American agave plant, which is blooming for the first time in its 80-year life since it was collected in Mexico back in 1934. That's a very interesting little bit of history. How did Mathai come into this plant exactly?
Well, the botanical gardens at the University of Michigan has been at a number of sites over the years, and this plant was in a pot at two other sites and then was brought here in the 60s when this property was donated by Fred Mathai Sr. and has been in the collection ever since and went into our desert house, and that's where it has been growing for since the 60s. And this is the year that it decided to send up a flower stalk.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Are these plants common or uncommon?
It's uncommon even in the Southwest to see them flowering. It's not a usual occurrence. I was talking with somebody at the Desert Botanic Garden, and she has them actually in her yard. And I was kind of surprised, but she said that you don't see them that often either. But in a conservatory in the Midwest, that's very uncommon.
When the plant really started to take off here, I believe you said it was in May, I know you reached a point where you had to accommodate the plant, which meant remodeling your greenhouse. Tell us about that.
Yes, we had to schedule a crew to come out and take a piece of glass off right above the stalk when it was about 2 feet from the glass so that the stalk could go through the glass, and it's well above the glass now. It's pretty impressive. What we've noticed is the flower buds above the glass have a different coloration to them. They're more colorful. They have an orangish tinge to them, probably because they're exposed to direct sunlight, where the flower buds below the glass are more greenish, yellowish.
And briefly, Mike, share with our listeners where they can learn more online about actually seeing the plant.
Yes, we have updates on our website, and we also have updates on our Facebook page at MBGNA.
MBGNA.com?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Okay, very good. Mike Palmer is horticulture manager at the Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor, where their American agave plant, 80 years old, is finally blooming. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Franz Kafka was one of the most influential writers of the 20th century. Some of his most famous works include The Metamorphosis and The Trial. The recent novel Forgiving the Angel by Jay Cantor offers a new spin on Kafka's legacy by fictionalizing the lives of the people who were close to the writer. Our book contributor Scott Southard has this review.
We all leave a legacy after we shuffle off this mortal coil, but its size and influence isn't decided by us. That power is in the hands of those we leave behind. Few writers have made as great an impact in literature as Franz Kafka. His existential stories filled with heroes stuck in inscrutable situations, like, for example, lost in an endless bureaucracy or unexpectedly turned into a roach, have influenced not only many other writers, but have even inspired his own word in the dictionary, Kafkaesque. Jay Cantor is one such influenced author, and his new collection of stories, Forgiving the Angel, takes on the impact of Kafka's legacy in a very unique fashion. Each of the real characters in this historical fiction is haunted by the memory of Kafka, and each dilemma is reminiscent of what Kafka will put his own characters through. Consider, for example, the first story, which follows the life of Max Brod. It is because of Max that we even know who Kafka is today. Kafka asked his dear friend to destroy his writing after his death, but Max didn't do that, instead finding publication for it. No reader today would debate that as a bad decision, of course, but for Max, this decision will overshadow any other part of his life and his own writing, leaving him as nothing more than a footnote in the literary history books. Then there is the story of Kafka's widow Dora and her second husband, Ludwig Lask, who could never hope to compete with Kafka's memory for her heart. Dora is still so infatuated with Kafka that she names their daughter Franziska, without a say, and that daughter refers to Kafka as her first father. Ludwig will go on to spend much of his story in the Soviet Gulag prison camps, held and tortured for really no specific reason, which can't help but make the Kafka reader remember his unfinished masterpiece, The Trial. Ludwig is not the only character to experience the hell of a prison camp. The last story in the collection follows one of Kafka's lovers, Milena, whose own story takes place in a Nazi concentration camp. As you can see, these tales, like Kafka's, are not happy ones and capture some of the dark moments in Europe's history. Forgiving the Angel is a book more for Kafka's fans and less for those who want to discover this important writer for the first time. Cantor's stories are best alongside Kafka's own fiction, stronger and more powerful when the reader knows that influence. Kafka's legacy over literature is vast, and Cantor taps into it very well. But when it comes to the legacy he left over those he knew, it seems that it was a bit, well, Kafka-esque. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott's the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. Scott Southard's writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, in place of our regular Current State broadcast, don't forget, WKAR is hosting Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer for a live statewide call-in hosted by the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta. Hope you've enjoyed today's show. Join us tomorrow for Democratic candidate Schauer. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.